Greetings, podcast listeners. Michael Shelley here. Marva Whitney passed away this week, and I thought I would rerun for just exclusively for you podcast listeners my 2009 interview with her. She was in town for a gig in Brooklyn somewhere, and so we chatted. She speaks a lot about her book that she's working on. As far as I know, I just checked Amazon. No book ever surfaced, so maybe it's finished and it will eventually see the light. That would be certainly interesting. A tribute to the interesting lady. It's a spirited conversation. Here she is, Marva Whitney. Now, who's talking
to? Yeah, the great Marva Whitney there. It is her thing, and she joins us on the telephone. Welcome to WFMU. Good morning. How are you?
Oh, I am blessed this morning.
You are Soul Sister number one. You are the first lady of funk. You are Marvelous Marva. You're Miss Excitement. you got a lot of nicknames.
I am that I am.
Yeah, you've earned it. You've got a big show coming up in town. And how do you feel? You've been doing it a long time, haven't you?
Well, yes and no.
Well, let's start at the beginning. Born in Kansas City. You had a big family, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm the oldest.
And was there music in the house? Did your folks sing? Was there radio? Was there a piano?
Oh, yes. We had a group called the Manning Gospel Singers. And
your dad was Ray Manning.
Yes. No, Ray Manning Gospel Singers is my oldest brother, one of the triplets that's born after me. They're called the Ray Manning Singers.
I see.
Which comes on 24/7 on the internet.
And so your brother started this group, and all the kids took part in it?
No. Well, we backed up from that. My grandmother, before she died, my mother was kind of disgusted because she had so many kids at one time. You know, three and then two, you know. So she got seven of us and you know, and four whops. And before my grandmother died, she told us, she said, these kids are going to sing one day. And sure enough, that did happen, and we went on the road.
And how old were you when that started?
Yeah.
How old were you when you...
I guess I was about 10, 11 years old, but I was 9 when my grandmother, when she passed, but I always did sing, they said, from the beginning, when Mama carried me, because Mother played piano at that time, and then later on went to play the organ, and we would travel over the United States, and it was a little much. We didn't know anything about the experience of taking alone someone to help Mother with the children, so it was mostly me and my mother and I, that would take care of the triplets and the twins. My baby brother wasn't born at that time, and my father worked for the Santa Fe, so he couldn't get off all the time.
Your dad worked for the railroad. And were you playing, was it mostly the South? Was it all over? Was it African-American places? Was it churches? What kind of?
It was churches, African-American. And we were doing good. We started, out in California and Las Vegas and Memphis, and we were doing real good. And
this is like early 1950s, right?
It would have been the latter 50s.
Okay.
My grandmother died in 54. And so when my mother got sick, she had a stroke. It was just too much. She just lost the will to carry a son, and to be truthful, I don't say it too often. It kind of disappointed me. I felt like that was the real notch. And if you listen to soul music, it's mostly church music, because a lot of your artists start from the church, but. People don't know how to give in the church, in the black churches especially at that time. And so they didn't do too much ticket selling. So it was, we made money, but not enough for Mother to struggle along.
And so were you, at age 12, you're already a bitter show business veteran, it sounds
if
like.
If you want to call it that.
Yeah.
I just felt a certain anointing, and I felt like, You know, I would think that, you know, like the Jackson 5, when I look back, you know, over time, I said, I had the idea like the Jackson 5.
Do you ever
you know, but we were singing, you know, church songs.
Do you ever get together with your brothers and sisters these days and sing?
I don't have a sister.
It's all brothers. Wow.
Yeah, I'm the only girl in the family, the oldest.
Holy mackerel.
And all of us are alive except for the baby of the triplets, Rayford. He died in the early 90s. Mm. And all of us do something musically. I play the piano. My brother's now into the recording business, and they have albums out, and it's called the Ray Manning Singers, and they DJs also on Saturday night at our black radio station, number one here, KPRS, on Saturday
so
night.
Everybody's still doing it. You were 16 years old. You joined another Kansas City group, the Alma Whitney Singers?
Yes, yes.
And you ended up marrying Harry Whitney?
Yes, I did. He died this year.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
Uh-huh.
And you also studied composition and voice.
Yeah, there was, as far as we were concerned, in that day, Mr. Willie Rice, he took time with the youngsters as far as learning standards, as learning everything through the gamut that would get us ready. And of course, he was on the board of the Musicians Union, which was, at that time was totally black, because there was a white one and a black one differently, but they have since then merged.
It's interesting. It's sort of a giant step from learning standards and studying at a conservatory to the funkiness, the James Brown sound that you were later known for. Is there a connection there? Was it important to learn the first one to be able to do the second one?
No. I've always liked all kind of music, even opera. I may not know who they are, but when they make those high notes, and I love it. So Mama said, "You've been nosy all your life." I would, you know, everybody has their own style. Everybody who has a craft, I believe, they never do the same thing twice. So with me, I'm subject to go into the heavy gospel, to the funk, to the opera, all in one song.
Wow.
Which is all related.
I guess so, and that's your style, a little of it all thrown in there.
Whatever my soul projects, that's what you're going to get.
You can't argue with that. You were, I guess, your late teen years, early 20s, you were working in the fashion business, you were doing office jobs, you were working at nighttime in clubs and talent competitions. I think you started singing with a local R&B group called Tommy and the Derbies, is
that's
that right?
That's right. And the Derbies, you heard of Loveland?
Charles
Gatson, the song Loveland.
Charles Wright and the Watts, 103rd Street Rhythm Band.
Yes,
right.
Well, that is his younger brother.
All right.
That's his younger brother. In fact, it was his 70th birthday party we had for him, I guess now about a month ago, for James Gatson here in Kansas.
I didn't get my invitation, but...
we had a good time.
Maybe for his 80th, I'll
and you know,
drop me a line.
We sung a song. We wouldn't go because we knew, the house was packed. They had good food. Everything was free.
What kind of food did they have?
We had a little this and a little that, and cornbread, macaroni and cheese, fried chicken, dressing, roast beef. I mean,
it sounds good.
It was so good.
So you fix a plate.
Yes, I did. I lit it with because I knew I was coming to New York, and when it's time to try to go to work, you know, and stuff, I start cutting down.
You got to fit into one of those stage dresses, those gowns.
Got to cut down.
Eventually, you're singing. I think you hook up with a manager, and he says, well, this James Brown show's coming to town, and I think maybe you start getting booked by the same booker as James Brown, and that's kind of the key, right? And that through that, you get an audition with James Brown, and you're about 23 years old at that time.
Okay. Mr. Cooper died, I guess, now it's been about 7 years, maybe, more or less. But I, with being the only female singer with Tommy and the Derbies, there was only one number one booking agency here called America's Best Attraction, with Alan Bell was the president, and he kept us working. He also kept Tina Turner, and all of them, anybody who was anybody, came through Alan Bell. And so we got a chance to travel a lot through that agency. However, Mr. Cooper had always been the kind that wanted. He tried Motown, trying to get in as a manager, trying to get in as a group he thought was ready to go. And at that particular time, I think I was the only lady that he had, and he told me, he said, I think I was watching TV. I didn't know I was going that day. And I think it was Easter. And he says, get ready. I got an interview. We're going to sing. Mr. Brown is here, and he needs a singer. And I was kind of blasé, you know, half ready, half not. Didn't have any stock.
You must have, James Brown was a huge star already. This is 1967. Was it music you were digging? Did you buy those records?
No. But there was a couple of songs I had heard on the radio that I liked. It was Man's World and There Was a Time. I said, ooh, that's groovy. And that was about as far as it would get, because to tell you the truth, in those days, me with a daughter and working, I didn't have too much, I wasn't too much of a radio listener. And so what I would do when it was come time for me to stay with what was current, either Tootie would pick it out, or either I would look at the Jets' top 10. And I would see, you know, I'd kind of listen to, you know, the females, what they were doing. And if I liked that, at that time, they were cooking. I'd pick out two or three of them.
And cover those songs. So tell me about the audition. What was it like? What did they put you through? What did they make you do?
I was kind of ticked off with that, because he had come to Kansas City, Kansas. That's the state in which I live. See, Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas, two different states,
right,
divided by water. And there were two shows, because the auditorium wasn't big enough to hold him. And so I thought, after they did the first show, you know, they'd go ahead and audition me, you know, see what it was.
Mm-hmm.
So I was ready. And all I could do is what I was going to do. And they tell me, Mr. Brown says he want to hear you after the second show. That kind of ticked me off.
So they made you
see it, too. Now, here I am, big old James Brown. I'm kind of ignorant to the fact, really, just how big this man is. And so Bobby Bennett, James Crawford, and Mr. Cooper, they kept me amused. And they was all cracking up and telling me how I was on the road and stuff. And it was interesting, you know. And so I was able to go through that. And then after the second show was over, I said, oh, this man going to hurry up and do what he got to do. Well, he was cooling down.
Right. I'm sure he needed to.
Yeah. And so he, Pee Wee, Alfred Ellis, who was the band leader at that time, went back to the dressing room and brought back a little tape, one of them little bitty ones during those days. And he said, Miss Brown want me to audition you, and we're going to put it on tape. I said, okay. And so he took me through here, and he took me through this maze and that maze, and he hit a chord I didn't really like. I said, no, hit it this way. And I think I surprised him.
Telling the band leader how to do it.
And I think that's when Pee Wee and I, we kind of clicked. He said, well, this girl is not quite a novice. I said, I've been playing for churches since I was 12 years old. Mm. You know, that's how I got my lunch money and stuff. And then he took it back to Mr. Brown, and I was nervous, kind of nervous then.
And so when did you start on the road? Obviously, you got the job. How many weeks went by or days till they said?
Well, he asked me, when he called me in, he told me he liked it and would I like to travel with him as a singer, because Vicki Anderson was going with Joe Tex. And I said, yeah, because we had went out on the road, the derbies and different places and stuff, and about starved to death, because we found out every town got its own clique. And you just don't walk in because you're good and get a gig. You got to suffer a while, because it got so bad that I went to work in Los Angeles, and I was a key puncher. And we was eating Rice Aroni before it was in Everett, May.
Before it was the San Francisco treat.
That would stretch.
Hey, let me remind everybody, this is Marva Whitney we're talking to, and she's got a big gig next Saturday at Southpaw, part of the Dig Deeper Soul Extravaganza that they put on every once in a while. You can check out myspace.com/digdeeperNYC or info on Marva at soulpower.info/marvawhitney.net. So you're on the road with James Brown. I don't know how to sort of say this.
Scared to death.
I don't know how to say this respectfully, but the guy was a crazy nut.
I tried to tell people that 30 years before, and they punished me for it. They didn't believe me. and when he made some mistakes in the 80s, things began to try to loosen up, but we still got in. People were still a little scared, but in the end, everything goes out right now. I want to encourage people right now who's listening to this. What is for you is for you. When I think of songs, excuse me, when I think of songs, I think through the gospel. And there were songs called Mahalia Jackson did Rain 40 Days, Rain 40 Nights. Then we had guitar players, lady guitar players that got a little mixed up. They didn't know if they wanted to be blues singers or guitar players. And they did Strange Things Happening Every Day.
Rosetta Tharpe, right?
There you go. And, you know, as I sat back and I got the call from Soul Power, he said, New York. Well, there's many things that happened during the last days that I was in New York. And dig this. It was in 69, December, and I'm getting a call to come to New York in 2009.
So 40 years later.
40 years later.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, it's like when things begin to open up, I'm so happy, because as you get older, sometime a lot of us, that new stuff we can't do, but it's like there was a revival of young people on up the older people that wanted to hear the stuff that I was blessed to do, which I couldn't stand, in the 60s.
Really?
And with the new engineering process, I could take it. And it sounds good to me.
Hmm. It's funny because as we were listening to It's My Thing, I was thinking, you know, well, you got a drummer and a bass player and a couple guitar players and some horns, and it's kind of timeless. It's not sort of like today's R&B music, which is going to sound dated, I think, 40 years from now. But that music still sounds just very straightforward. Tell me about recording sessions with James Brown, because when you got part of his organization, you got signed to the King label, and you immediately started cutting tracks with James Brown. His band was fiercely good at that time. I mean, he may have been a crazy nut, but he sure could sing and could play and could put some music together.
I love him for it. I have the highest respect for him, even though at some time I didn't know which personality I was talking to. But he was a genius, and he had 101 things on his mind. But when I first got with him, like you said, I signed with King Records, not knowing the reason why until here lately. It was really his label, because they weren't paying him either. And so what he would do, he would take it out and like stop. And that's how he began to get more, have more stock than the president.
Yeah, I never heard that.
And you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the way he was getting his money. So when he said press, when he said stop. But there was a lot of things in the can. And that means at that time, Charles Sperling was the A&R man for King Records, Bethlehem, and a lot of that, and it was mostly a country and western. But he had things in the can which had the wrong keys. And in them days, they couldn't roll the key down or up. And it was out of, even though I sing high, sometimes you don't need it like that. So he had a lot of things in the can, and he just, Mr. Brown wasn't even there. They just pick it up and say, he said, do this. and have about maybe 10 minutes, 30 minutes.
So there'd be a track that had been recorded that maybe was in the wrong key for James Brown. They say, let Marvel Whitney take a shot at it?
It might have been like that, or just a song, period.
Interesting. We heard earlier today your version of Sunny with James Brown, which, so obviously you're in the room together for that, right?
Yeah.
That sounds like a lot of fun. I mean, it sounds like at times it must have been fun.
Well, there were some good times. There were some good times, Mr. Brown and I. But you never know when they were coming.
There's a clip of you guys on the Mike Douglas show, which is you can watch that on the internet. It's kind of crazy.
I'm scared.
Yeah,
I'm scared.
It's very, and looks like Mike Douglas might be a little bit scared too.
Who wasn't scared? They didn't know what was going on.
Well, James Brown is an intense guy. You know, a really intense guy. You're on the Live at the Apollo Volume 2, which is, you know, one of the great live records ever recorded. You also got to go to England, Germany, Denmark, France, Korea, Japan, Vietnam, even and playing in front of the troops and stuff. You got to travel all around the world.
Yes, I did.
That must have been very exciting for a girl from Kansas, you know.
Well, yes and no. You had to be able to switch personalities also, because I got it from Mr. Brown, and I got it from the people. Let's say 98% from the people who were already there. When a new girl on the block, they know things I don't know. They like the previous. They like the singer they have, and they got to put up with a new person. I don't look too bad. They know things I don't know, and which relates to the book that I have coming out. Should be out in It should be out the end of October.
Oh, you're right. And is the book, you talk to tell the whole story of your time with James Brown and that whole experience?
Yes, it's very juicy.
Well, I cannot wait to I mean, it seems like, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but it seems like he must have been on drugs some of the time.
With me. Now, I'll tell you the truth. With me, Mr. Brown, he liked Ripple.
Ripple.
You know, Red Fox Ripple?
Yeah.
And he wasn't a man that indulged.
Hmm.
And if he did, it wasn't around me.
Hmm.
And I was with him quite a bit. And but after I left, things somehow begin to change. And I'm not saying all because of me. I know he thought about all the money he had probably put out on me for me to get some of these shows, you know, and different things. And maybe he was unhappy about that because I was the only young lady that left and never came back.
Hmm.
Because he had, which you were reading in the book, it's called James Brown, the Devil, and Marva Whitney. And I didn't come back for him to kick me. I sat there for about 6 months. The last 6 months, I knew I wasn't going to be there long, because I could see things that was happening. And when they come back and they thought they were in the pocket and made peace and everything like that, well, he sent them on their way when they got comfortable.
Hmm. Interesting. This sounds like a book that I would love to read.
Well, I'm hoping you do. I'm hoping everybody that's listening and will enjoy it.
Well, after you left the James Brown family, you recorded for T-Neck, the Isley Brothers label, a few other labels, and you still were playing and stuff. You had put a few...
Like Starve Death.
A few hits on the charts, so you were still an...
Starve Death.
Sounds like maybe...
It was like from riches to rag. I thought that, as I thought about it years later, being from Kansas, you know, we think a little slower, kind of this country town. You know, we're true blue. Your word is your bond and stuff like that. I said, oh my goodness, you know, I've got a chance with the Isley Brothers, which was giving James a fit at that time with it's your thing, So that's how we come out with It's My Thing. And but as I think about it, and you know, some of this stuff, since a few things are happening for me right now, which I hope will go up and up and up and up, it's just now coming back.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, I was just naive. Well, see, they felt that since it was their song, it wasn't too much I could do to it as far as changing words. And so they just used me to say, well, if you don't do this, we're going to put this out, and if you don't give us some money.
Hmm.
And that's what that was all about.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the song... let's talk about sampling. Some of your songs have been sampled. Unwind Yourself has been sampled a number of times. Is that something that you get money from when that happens?
Well, you know what? I'm glad you said that, because last night I was sitting up here thinking, they have a commercial here, and it's a drummer, and I don't know him, and he's drumming, and he's talking about music. I've tried to get my royalties. I have never been paid royalties for anything until James sold some of his songs that we did in the late 80s, and we might have got a little bit every now and then in the late 90s.
Hmm.
But anyway, I looked into that, and I don't understand this, and maybe some of your people can tell me. I told them that I felt that I was due something from that song, which was in Let Me Clear My Throat, LL Cool J, and they told me that drums was not considered music. What?
That sounds ridiculous.
No, yeah. Drums? y'all give me some money.
You need a lawyer, yeah, Marva. Yeah, that song's been sampled
by Social Security. I'm Social Security age, and I look up, and nothing's been turned in for me for Social Security. But God is good. My God is good.
Your record, It's My Thing, is on CD. There's some tracks of yours on James Brown Original Funky Divas compilation and on the James Brown Funky People. And you're out there, you're doing stuff, you're still making great music. When's the last time you spoke to James Brown? Did you speak to him before he died?
Yes, I did. And I'll tell you, it was real strange. Through the years, it took a while for me to go back and just say hello. As you will find in the book, because I want to do something else, you know, because right. I couldn't work. They were scared of me. But 2 months before he died, he came here, Mr. Bobbitt. Everybody know Mr. Charles Bobbitt, his manager, road manager. And he says, Mr. Brown says, for you to be ready, not do you want to go, for you to be ready at 7 o'clock, and limousine will pick you up. I said, you tell Mr. Brown. I have been there to see him several times, which I've had a good time, and he's always treated me royally when I did come around. But you tell him this time I don't have the time to come. And see, you don't talk to him like that. Yes, sir. And you tell him, if you want to do something for me, send for me somewhere where people haven't seen me in 40 years because they think I'm dead. And I said, so tell him to send me, you know, send for me somewhere where they know I'm alive so I can work. You know,
right?
And I said, so tell him I will not be there. And that was like October, somewhere right in there. And I got a call right into one of the original JB dancers, Houston. Her name is last name is Houston. And she was the young lady that's always danced in the middle. And she's crying, 12 o'clock at night, and it's just now Christmas. And she's, what's the matter? What's the matter? What's the matter? Mr. Brown is gone. He dead. I said, what? She was the only one that called me. She said, pack a bag and get down here. I'll call my mother. I said, Mama, should I do that? She said, if you don't, everybody's going to be mad at you. I could not get an airplane. So I got on Greyhound. Wow. Do a few things, maybe a dress or two, a couple pair of pants. And I didn't know I was going to sing it on the film or anything. They didn't tell me nothing. There was the same old thing that had been happening to me for the last 40 years with that group. They kept blocking me.
That's amazing.
And but the master would not have it that way. And so that's what happened. And it was he had it down that he wanted me to sing.
Amazing. Well, let me remind folks, it's WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and WFMU.org. It's Michael Shelley, and my guest is Marva Whitney today. She's got a big show coming up next Saturday at Southpaw in Brooklyn, New York, and information and tickets available at myspace.com/digdeepernyc. What kind of a show? What are we going to see there?
Well, are you going to see Marvin Whitney?
It sounds like you're a lot of fun. It sounds like you've got some energy, you know.
I got, you know what, because I can't believe it. Where I ended off, it's like a pickup from where I left.
Okay. I've got a song queued up here. We've got Unwind Yourself. We talked about how often it's been sampled. It's a real funky, terrific song. You remember cutting this record?
Yes, I do. I like that song.
Tell me about the putting it together.
Well, let me see. It was Hank Ballard did it first. And I covered it. And we covered a lot of each other's songs.
Yeah, James Brown loved Hank Ballard.
Yes, he did. Yeah. Yes, he did. Until one point, and if you read the book, you'll find out at one point why they had a little trouble.
He turned on Hank Ballard, too. I see. Well, we're going to have you back on when this book comes out, because I want to discuss the dirt a little bit more. Marva Whitney, it's been great to talk to you, and I guess we'll see you next Saturday, the 26th, at Southpaw in Brooklyn.
All right, and I wanted to thank you and your fans so much, and just thank you for keeping me alive and resurrecting me and everything.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Bye.